joins the beggars. It is a terrible, dreary existence. It's no kind of existence at all. As she disappears around a corner, I suddenly find myself walking toward the nearest door. My plans for the library are forgotten, and instead, I join the others going down to the heart of the village for Bao's sunset funeral. I'm not sure what it is that draws me. At first, I think that Zhang Jing's plight has driven home the tragedy of what happened to Bao. But when I reach the edge of the crowd gathered for the ceremony, I understand what has really drawn me here. Li Wei. For the first time in a while, that dazzling childhood memory doesn't immediately come to mind as I stare at him. That inescapable attraction and the emotional fallout from joining the artists still burns within me. But it too is momentarily subdued. What pulls me to him now is his sense of loss and his rage at the situation our people are locked into. It resonates with the pain I feel over Zhang Jing. And although I don't know if he'll want to talk to me, I know I have to try. He stands near the front of the crowd, his back straight and tall, and his face proud and almost haughty. As usual, though, it's his eyes that betray his otherwise tough exterior. I see the emotion brimming in them, and my own heart aches in answer. I know him well enough to understand that he's using every ounce of self-control to remain calm in front of the others. I wish I could run forward and clasp his hands, let him know it's okay to grieve, and show how he feels. He wears a white shirt, undoubtedly borrowed from a community source. In the old days, it was written every villager would come out in white for a funeral. When trade down the mountain became restricted, however, our clothing supply diminished. Now only the immediate family is granted white, from a closely guarded communal supply. Even though the color has sad connotations, I'm moved by how striking Li Wei looks when he's cleaned up and in something other than those muddy work clothes. It's not something I've seen very much. He looks almost regal once the dirt is washed away, like someone who could lead and command attention rather than toil away in a dark mine. The priest bows before the memorial altar, which has already been set with a sacred lamp, 2 candles, and 5 cups. His assistants bring forward incense, which he adds to the altar and lights with great ceremony. Soon the scent of sandalwood wafts to where I stand. The priest goes through the familiar signs and dances, and although I watch respectfully, my mind wanders. With the blindness has come an increase in funerals, and we are all too familiar with this ceremony. I focus again on Li Wei, thinking about his words and his conviction. Did he mean what he said? Is he really going to attempt to leave and go down the mountain? Perhaps he was only speaking in anger. Yet, as I study him closely, something tells me what he said wasn't an impulse. I wouldn't be surprised if he's been planning his journey for a long time. He simply needed a strong enough reason to spur him on. His father's death provided it. My thoughts are suddenly jarringly interrupted by a noise that nearly makes me jump out of my own skin. It's a sign of both my internal struggles and my ability to adapt, that in only a couple of days I've learned to tune out many background noises. Noises that initially overwhelmed me. Now, in this short time, I find myself ignoring many common sounds and focusing on those that either directly affect me or are particularly noticeable. This one sets my teeth on edge, and I search for its source. In the priest's direction, one of his assistants has just struck a ceremonial gong. My eyes widen as I realize that monstrous noise was caused by a gesture I'd seen countless times at funerals and other rituals. I never realized that noise was the end result. I look around, desperate to see if anyone else reacted, but they're all respectfully watching the priest, Well, everyone except the older woman standing next to me, who noticed when I flinched. "Do you know why they hit the gong?" I ask. The woman bows in acknowledgement to my station, and then answers, "It is to scare evil spirits who might delay the deceased's journey." She pauses. "That is what my grandmother told me, at least. I don't know why hitting it scares them. Perhaps it is magical." I thank her and turn back to the ceremony. Despite the grim circumstances, I almost want to smile. I'm not sure I believe in that kind of superstition, but I certainly understand how our ancestors thought the gong could frighten away evil spirits. All this time, I'd had no idea of its true purpose. No one did. For generations, the priests have just continued using the gong out of habit, long after anyone could hear it anymore. I wonder how many other things like this were lost to us when sound disappeared. And why, I ask myself for the 100th time, am I the only one who has had this sense restored? When the funeral ends, Li Wei is surrounded by those wishing to offer condolences. A number of them are girls our age, and while they look legitimately sorry for his loss, part of me questions their motives. I can't be the only one who goes weak-kneed around him. And I really don't know how he spent his free time since I joined the artists. It'd be reasonable for him to turn his attentions to someone else. The thought troubles me more than it should, considering how Sheng and I were matched. When the last of Li Wei's sympathizers leaves, I follow him as he walks alone from the village's center. I pass a cluster of beggars as I do, their sad plight bringing Zhang Jing to mind. My resolve strengthens, and I tap Li Wei's shoulder when he heads down a path that leads to a group of small houses. He turns, looking surprised to see me, and possibly a little exasperated, considering how we last left things. "What do you want?" he asks. His harsh response is almost enough to make me flinch. Mustering my courage, I bow and give the proper condolences offered in these situations. "I am very sorry for the loss of your father. May his spirit live in immortality."
"Thank you,"
Li Wei responds, but he is clearly suspicious that there is more to come. I make sure no one else is around before dropping the formalities. "Are you still planning on leaving?" His face hardens.
"Yes. Why? Are you going to tell someone? Try to get them to stop me?"
"No." He regards me expectantly, and I take a deep breath, summoning my strength. I want to come with you." The words fly from my hands before I can stop them. The idea has been brewing in the back of my mind all evening, but until I said it, I hadn't consciously realized that's what I was going to do. Zhang Jing's plight has made me realize that things will never change, unless someone makes them change. Li Wei stares incredulously at me, and then lets out a laugh with a harsh edge to it.
"You? Pampered, prized apprentice? You aren't that bold little girl anymore. Stop wasting my time. I have things to do."
He shakes his head and starts to walk away, but I catch his sleeve. Remembering the effect touching him had on me last time, I'm careful to promptly let go and keep a respectful distance. "What bold little girl?" I ask, puzzled. He hesitates.
"The one who climbed the rotten shed, even though she knew it was dangerous. Just to prove she could. I thought you were so brave back then. Brave and bold and beautiful. I always believed that over the years until... well, you've changed."
My heart lurches at all the misunderstandings that have arisen between us. "I haven't," I say. "Look, I thought about what you said, about how it isn't enough to just keep getting by day after day as we are. I saw my sister, and she's exactly like that. not happy with her life, but convinced there's nothing more. I can't let her go on like that, with nothing else to hope for. I want to help you. I want to talk to the Keeper, too, and see if there's a way to change things. It all comes out in a jumble, not nearly as eloquent as I'd hoped. Li Wei studies me for several long moments. The earlier rain clouds have passed. With the sun down and the moon still rising, torches light the paths around the village, casting flickering light and shadows. But I can see well enough to know he's trying to decide if I'm speaking the truth. Unless I'm mistaken, I even see a flash of hope in his eyes, as though he too wonders if there might be a way to repair our past. At last, he shakes his head again.
No, it's too dangerous, Fei. You wouldn't be able to handle it. I'm already going to have my work cut out for me, keeping myself alive. I can't allow myself to worry about you the whole time.
I won't be a burden, I insist. I can help you. Now he looks amused.
How? Will you win the linekeeper over by drawing him a picture?
I sigh in irritation. Clap your hands, I tell him. He stares in understandable confusion. I gesture impatiently, and with a shrug, he claps three times. The sounds are short and loud. Now do it again, I say, just before turning around. I wait and hear nothing. After several seconds pass, I look back and glare. You didn't clap. He looks a little surprised, but shrugs.
What's the point?
Just do it, I insist. I turn my back to him, and this time he claps. I face him once more. You just clapped three times. His face is understandably puzzled at this exercise, but he doesn't yet seem to grasp that anything unusual is happening.
So, that's what I did before.
Then clap a different number of times, and I'll tell you the amount. Seeing his baffled look, I add, do it. He claps four times, and I tell him the number, then two, then seven. The last time, he doesn't clap at all, and when I turn around, his eyes are impossibly wide. You didn't clap that time, I say.
How are you doing this?
He asks. I steel myself, working up the courage to state what I can barely believe myself. I can hear the sounds. They're caused when you clap. I don't understand it, but somehow my hearing has returned. I hear this. I hear all sorts of things. The idea is so ludicrous, so beyond our everyday experience, that Li Wei can't even try to take it seriously. He looks at me like we're children again, caught up in a game.
It's some kind of trick. Come on, Fei, tell me how you're really doing it.
It's not a trick, I tell him. It's been going on for almost 2 days, and I don't understand it. That's why I was so distracted earlier when your father died. Li Wei, you're the first person I've told. You must believe me. He scrutinizes me intently.
It's impossible,
he says, though his expression isn't so certain.
Hearing is gone for us.
Not for me, I say.
Why just you, then?
I wish I knew. You can't even begin to imagine what this has been like. The burden of carrying this secret is catching up with me, and I think Li Wei is beginning to realize this. His expression softens, filling with an affection I haven't seen in him in a long time. Out of habit, he reaches for me, wanting to comfort me like he might have in our childhood. I nearly let him, but the importance of what's at stake enables me to push aside my own desires. Stepping back, I try to look tough. Look, I say, believe me or not, but the point is, I can help you on this trip. Maybe I can communicate with the linekeeper. I can certainly help in other ways. I pick up a small stone on the path's side and hand it to Li Wei. Throw it at one of those trees. I turn around again and wait. After a pause, I hear a sharp sound off to my left. When I face him again, I point in that direction. There, you threw it over there.
It's impossible,
he repeats. But I can see in his face that, despite whatever reason is telling him otherwise, he's daring to believe my story.
How? How did this happen? Faye, you must have some idea.
I don't, I say. I really don't. But it seems to be here to stay, and as long as I've got it, it can be helpful. If I can hear where you just threw the stone, I'll be able to hear when stones are falling on the climb down. His breath catches as understanding hits him, and for the first time in our acquaintance, he is at a loss for words. At last, he lifts his hands to speak.
Perhaps you might be useful on this trip after all.
Chapter 6. When I return to the dormitory later that night, I'm certain that everyone will notice my nervousness and excitement. But much like my hearing, the storm of emotions churning inside is apparent only to me. The other apprentices who went to the funeral have returned, and everyone is preparing for bed. I'm certain if Zhang Jing had still been in my room, she would have noticed something was amiss. But my sister is on the other side of the school, with the servants. I change for bed and slip under the covers dutifully, just like all the other girls in my room. Darkness descends, lit only by peeps of moonlight shining through the edges of the blinds. Soon my roommates fall into sleep, and the room is filled with the soft sounds of what I've come to recognize as breathing. Sometimes I find that sound oddly soothing, but tonight I'm too anxious to give it much thought. I have hours to wait until I can spring into action, and my mind is spinning with all the things that can go wrong on the journey I'm about to embark upon with Li Wei. It took some time for us to come up with a plan. Neither of us was sure if anyone would try to stop us when we left. It isn't that climbing down is forbidden, it's just that no one has ever really attempted to do it. Both of us are valued for different reasons. I am valued for my artistic skill set, and he is valued because of the village's burning need to mine more metals. It's possible others might prevent us from leaving simply to keep us in the workforce. Leaving under cover of darkness will be our best chance of escape. That will make our descent even more dangerous. But the moon is full and bright tonight. We will get our start by its light and be far enough down by sunrise that no one can stop us. Around that time, most villagers will still be getting up and preparing for the day, walking to the center to read the record. My absence will be noticed before Li Wei's, but it seems unlikely the masters will guess where I've gone. The hours drag by as I lie in bed, analyzing our plan and how I'm going to proceed. I know rest will help me, but I can't risk sleeping and missing when I need to get up. I track the moon's position outside, and at last the time comes for me to begin. I slip out of my bed and out of the room, heading toward the servants' wing of the school. My eyes dart everywhere, looking for signs of activity, but I soon realize my ears will serve me better. I hear footsteps and spot a servant on night watch heading toward me from an adjacent hall. I duck into a doorway, crouching in the shadows until he passes. He stifles a yawn as he goes by, never guessing anyone else is up and about. I'm not familiar with the servant's wing. We have more rooms in the Peacock Court than we have need for, and it takes me a few tries to find the laundry room. I strip off my nightgown and change into a clean set of apprentice clothes intended for a boy. They're the same blue I usually wear, but instead of a girl's long skirt, they have pants paired with a wrap top. Wearing them feels a little strange at first, but I know they'll be infinitely more practical than my skirt for climbing. The laundry room also has a small knapsack that I take, adding a spare change of clothes for myself. I next make my way to the kitchen. It too has a servant on watch, and I recognize her as the intimidating head cook. She sits in a chair near the back door, sewing by the light of a small lamp to keep herself awake. I'm not sure if her presence is a result of the recent theft, or a precaution always taken. All I know is that if she catches me, my rank won't save me from her wrath. At the moment, her focus is on her sewing, and she's angled in such a position as to allow me some freedom of movement out of her sight. She doesn't see me slipping in through the door that leads to the rest of the school, and I creep around the kitchen, watching her carefully and listening for any signs of movement. Several times, she shifts position and forces me to duck or seek other cover. I find a table where lunches for the coming day have been prepared and neatly laid out. It's the kind of food meant to be packed and stored easily, ideal for the journey I'm about to undertake. And yet my fingers hesitate as I reach for it. Stealing food is a grave crime. Everyone is hungry, and I hate the thought of depriving someone else. I find small comfort in knowing that one of the ration bags I take would have been my own lunch tomorrow. Li Wei and I don't know what we'll find at the bottom. Maybe when we get there, we'll find a land of plenty. Or maybe the township sends us small amounts simply because they too are starving. After much deliberation, I take 3 more packs, giving Li Wei and me 2 meals each. We will have to fend for ourselves once these run out. A long, drawn-out sound catches my attention, and I duck into the shadows, searching for the source of the noise. It is one of the doors from the servant's wing being opened. The servant I saw in the hall earlier enters the kitchen, heading over toward the chef. They have a conversation I can see only part of, but it appears to be a status check, verifying all is well. While they are speaking, I seize the opportunity to dart out of the kitchen. I'm about to take the hall that leads to a side exit when I notice another corridor. In searching for the laundry room and the kitchen, I encountered most of the areas that the servants work in, which makes me think this must be their living quarters. I need to be on my way, but I just can't bring myself to leave without seeing Zhang Jing one last time. In a moment, I've made my choice, and I turn down the hall, carefully peeking in each room. Many doors make that same long noise the kitchen door did, and I'm grateful no one else can hear it. If I ever get a chance to read Feng Jie's book again, I intend to learn what the name for that sound is. At last, I find where the servant women sleep. The space is smaller than my bedroom, but with more beds crammed into it. Zhang Jing is sleeping at the end of the room, her bed up against the wall. I lean over her, feeling my heart ache as I take in the features of her beloved face. With a pang, I suddenly wonder if I'll ever see her again. Li Wei and I have no idea what we'll find at the bottom. We don't even know if we'll reach the bottom. What will happen if I die? Who will take care of Zhang Jing then, especially if her sight goes? The fear is almost enough to make me change my mind about the journey. Then I remind myself that while there are risks, there's also the chance that I might be able to change everything, not just for Zhang Jing, but for others in my village. Whatever it is we find, more food, answers about the blindness, it has the possibility of improving the world of those we know and love. Li Wei is making this journey regardless, and he needs every asset he can get. I am one of those assets. I smooth Zhang Jing's hair from her face, my touch as light as a feather. She shifts slightly, but continues sleeping peacefully, her cheek on her pillow and hand underneath it, just as she has slept since childhood. I look around the room. Along with a bowl of water on a table, there are some scraps of paper and a pot of ink resting on a shelf. I go to it, and in the moonlight I write a brief note. I will be back with help. Trust me. I take the scrap of paper and tuck it under Zhang Jing's pillow near her hand. She will feel it when she awakens and hopefully have faith in what I am doing. I have no doubt my disappearance will eventually be linked to the theft of the food, and I hate the thought of her believing the worst of me, especially after she told me how my position brings prestige to our family. Knowing I'm risking throwing that all away, I place a gentle kiss on her forehead. I give my sister one last fond look and make my way out of her room. The patrolling servant is back on his rounds, but I dodge him, winding through the corridors until I reach a side door. Although I don't expect there to be many people out this time of night, this door is less exposed than the main one, allowing a more discreet exit. Keeping to the shadows, I follow paths and trails until I reach the spot on the outskirts of our village that Li Wei and I had both agreed on, the place where our ancestors used to mount climbs from, farther up the trail from where the supply line is, and it is where I find Li Wei waiting.
"You're late," he signs to me in the moonlight. "I thought maybe you'd changed your mind, or feared the restless spirits that come out at night."
"I stopped believing in them when I stopped believing in Pishus," I respond haughtily. "I had to say goodbye to Zhang Jing." Shock fills his face.
"You told her?"
No. I just checked on her while she was asleep. No one knows." I pat my knapsack. "And I found food, just as I promised. Did you get the things you need?" He gestures to a pile of equipment near his feet. Some of it, like the ropes, look like gear I'd find among the miners. Other items, metal rings, spikes, and hammer-like tools, are beyond me.
"Some of this is from the mines," he confirms. "The rest is from the magistrate's supply shed. It has been stored there for centuries, but I was able to find pieces still in good shape."
His face darkens.
"I had to steal all of it."
"I know," I tell him. "I had to steal the food, too." He shakes off his dismay and forces a smile.
"None of that will matter when we return with new supplies, right?"
"Right," I say, trying to smile back. I don't bother pointing out what he already knows, that there's no guarantee we'll make it back, let alone with any bounty. "Do you know how to use this stuff?"
"Much of it works like what we've used in the mines," he tells me. "I've read up on what I don't know and made some inquiries in the past."
He glances up at the sky, where the full moon is descending in the west, still bright. In the east, however, I see a faint purpling of the sky as the sun readies itself for the day.
"Ready to go?"
"Ready as I'll ever be," I reply. He gives me a quick primer on the basics of the equipment, and then shocks me when he uses some of the rope to tie us together. He grins when he sees my astonishment.
"Nervous about being so close to me?"
he asks, giving the rope a slight tug. I cross my arms, refusing to be baited by that dangerous question, even if there is truth to it. But whatever my feelings for him, I must focus on the larger picture. Zhang Jing and our village's future. "Don't get any ideas," I warn. A small smile tugs at his lips.
"And what kind of ideas would those be, apprentice?"
"You know what kind of ideas. Just because we're going on this journey, it doesn't mean anything has changed. I meant what I said 2 years ago. My life has taken a different course. We can't be together." I cross my arms imperiously, hoping I am convincing and that I'm not letting on that his nearness makes my pulse quicken. He scrutinizes me, trying to determine if I'm telling the truth.
"Very well," he says. "If that's the way you feel, far be it from me to interfere."
He gives the rope around my waist a test tug.
"There. It's an older rope, but it should hold. I can't risk you slipping and falling," he explains. "This way I can help you."
"Or go down with me," I point out.
"Then don't fall,"
he advises. The ropes and rings become a confusing web to me, but Li Wei understands them and how they'll work to keep us safe. He secures our climbing ropes at the top of the cliff and hands me a pair of miner's gloves. Although we are loosely tied to each other, we each have our own rope to rappel down with, and I grip mine with a tightness born out of fear as much as necessity. Li Wei makes the first leap, launching himself over the edge. A pit opens up in my stomach as I watch him drop, but then the rope goes taut in his grip, and his feet land on the mountain's stony face, securing his position. Stable and safe, he glances up at me nonchalantly, as though what he just did was perfectly ordinary, easy even. I'm sure I look terrified, but there is no coddling from Li Wei. The challenge in his gaze spurs me on, and before I have a chance to second-guess myself, I leap over the edge as well. I do exactly as he did, hopping only a short distance down, but that first leap feels 100 miles long. The air rushes past me, and for a few terrifying seconds, I feel as though I'm floating, with nothing to save me. Then my feet strike the mountain side with a teeth-rattling jolt. The rope above me holds true, and I squeeze it tightly, grateful for its security, yet fully aware that its security is a tenuous thing. One snap, one slip, and there would be nothing to save me from the drop. Li Wei nods at me in approval, and with that, our journey begins. I've climbed and played on ropes before, especially when I was younger. I have the strength to do it, but it's been a long time. My hands, more used to the delicate work of painting and drawing, are unaccustomed to this type of labor, and soon begin to hurt from the exertion. I refuse to let Li Wei see my pain, however, and keep pace with him as we descend the rocky mountain face in the moonlight. We've only been going a few minutes when I hear rocks crashing and realize holding a rope requires both hands. I can't signal to Li Wei that we've triggered our first avalanche. Panicked, I twist my hips in a way that tugs our adjoining rope. He looks over at me, and I jerk my head to my opposite side. Understanding, he quickly drops and swings off in the other direction, making room for me to take his spot just as a tumble of rocks falls near my original position. When they are gone and all is quiet, I stay frozen where I am, feet planted on the cliff and hands clinging tightly to the rope. My heart is racing frantically at the close call, and despair starts to hit me as I squeeze my eyes shut. The journey has barely started, and we've already faced a rock slide. How can we possibly make it to the bottom? A tug at the joining rope makes me open my eyes. I look over at Li Wei, and his face is strong and calm as he meets my gaze. Although he can't speak, the conviction in his expression tells me what he would say.
We can do this. I need you. You are still that brave girl who climbed the shed.
I take a deep breath and try to force calm. He does need me. Zhang Jing needs me too. After several more tense seconds, I give a short nod to let him know I'm ready to keep going. He smiles encouragingly, one of those rare, wonderful smiles that transforms his whole face. And we continue with our descent. It is slow, painstaking work. We have to be careful of every move we make, and more rocks follow those initial ones. Some are avoidable. In some cases, we find it's best just to freeze and cling to the side, waiting for the rocks to pass. We work out a system of tugs with our adjoining ropes and head gestures to help us determine what to do. When we take our first true break, I'm unsure how much time has passed. But the moon has gone, and sunrise is now lighting our way. We come across a relatively flat piece of rock, jutting out and leading to a shallow cave. Li Wei tests the rock ledge, and deems it safe for us to sit on and rest as he gathers up excess line and prepares for the remainder of the climb. I exhale and stretch my legs, surprised at how tense my muscles have grown. The top of the mountain, where we started, looks impossibly far away. Glancing down, though, the bottom is farther still, hidden in mist. For a moment, I am dizzy as I contemplate my position here, suspended between heaven and earth. Li Wei's hands move in my periphery.
"Don't do that,"
he says. "Do what?" He gestures around.
"That, looking up and down. It will overwhelm you."
"You talk like a seasoned climber," I tease, "like you do this all the time."
"I've done similar things in the mines. Nothing on this scale."
After a moment, he gives me a grudging smile.
"You're doing well."
"Better than you expected?" I ask. He looks me over, his gaze lingering a bit longer than it needs to.
"No, I knew you could do it."
I nod in acknowledgement and glance around, trying to do as he says and not focus on the top or bottom of the climb. Here, on this small perch, I'm struck by how still everything is. Back in the village during the day, there was always an abundance of sound. Here, there is very little, and I enjoy the small respite. Is this silence? No, I decide, thinking back to the writings I read. Silence is no sound, the way I lived before. This is merely quiet, because some noises still come through to me. The sound of my feet shifting on the rock, faint wind blowing past us.
"What is it like?"
Li Wei asks, his face solemn once more.
"Being able to hear."
I shake my head. "It's too hard to explain."
"Why?"
he asks. "Even describing it, well, it uses words you wouldn't understand. It's like another language."
"Then use words I do know,"
he suggests. I think long and hard before answering. "Imagine if everything you saw, your entire life, was always a shade of gray. Then one day you blink, and suddenly you see the world as it is with all its colors. Blue, red, yellow. How would you react? How would you handle literally not having the words to describe what you're experiencing?"
"Some things don't need words,"
he says after a moment. And I wonder if he's still talking about sound. "Everything needs a word," I insist. "We need to know how to describe the world. Otherwise, we'd fall into ignorance."
"Spoken like someone who spends her days organizing and cataloging everything. Sometimes, it's enough to just feel. You don't have to label and articulate all that's around you."
I roll my eyes. "Spoken like a barbarian." He laughs at that, and there's a warmth in it that makes me smile. We split one of the lunch packs and then begin climbing down once more. There are a few more close calls as small stones skitter down the cliff. I'm able to warn him with tugs of the rope, but our system is cumbersome and delayed. A couple of times when he clears his throat or coughs, my attention is immediately drawn to him by those sounds. It gives me new appreciation for how our ancestors used to communicate with their mouths. Speech. The concept was always foreign to me when I read about it, but now I see how much simpler it would be if there was a sound I could make to warn Li Wei of the next avalanche. Morning gives way to noon, and we see a huge plateau jutting out of the mountain, promising another break. Beyond it, I can actually make out the ground at the mountain's base. Hope surges in me that we might pull this off after all. Then I hear the sound signaling another avalanche. I look up, and it is not a small scattering of stones like we've encountered before. Large boulders are tumbling down toward us. They create vibrations in the cliff face that even Li Wei can sense, though he doesn't immediately ascertain the direction. I have no time to tug and point. Clinging to my rope, I push off with my feet and swing toward him, knocking him off the cliff face. He loses his footing, but keeps hold of the rope. For a terrifying moment, we are both swinging in the air with only our grip on the ropes to keep us from falling. A cascade of rocks begins tumbling beside us, far too close. The sound created is soft at first, almost like an exhalation of breath, but soon grows into a roar as the stones increase in number. One of them strikes my head and I wince. The instinct to shield myself with my hands is overwhelming, but letting go means certain death. Both of us scramble for footholds, trying to move out of the way of the growing rockfall. Li Wei swings hard and almost manages to land on another small outcropping, but the added weight of being tied to me throws him off. A second attempt also fails. He tries yet again, harder this time, and is at last able to land on the edge. With his footing secure, he scuttles back and tugs me toward him with the adjoining rope. My feet make contact with the ledge, and he pulls me forward into his arms, leaving us cowering against the mountain as a full-on avalanche of boulders cascades beside us. The falling rocks keep triggering more avalanches, and it is spectacular and terrifying to watch. When it finally ends, we are both shaking, shocked by how close we came to being caught in the full force of it. I let him hold me a few moments longer, before reluctantly breaking the embrace. He gestures to my cheek.
"You're bleeding,"
he says. I vaguely recall the rock that hit me, and am now aware of a stinging sensation. I lightly touch the side of my face with my fingertips, and see blood when I remove them. I dab again, and see less blood. "It's nothing," I say. "It's already stopping."
"Here, let me clean it."
He pulls his sleeve over his hand and reaches for me. I shrink back. "What are you doing?" I ask.
"Wiping up the blood," he says.
"Not with that filthy shirt," I retort. "And I told you, I'm fine. No need to stain your shirt even more."
"I'm a barbarian, remember?"
His grin fades as concern returns to his features.
"Perhaps we should rest longer."
"For me?" I ask indignantly. I get to my feet and hope I'm not still shaking. "There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not some delicate flower. I'm ready to go now."
"Fay, it's okay if we take a break,"
he says.
"There's no need to let your pride get the best of you. Again."
"Again?" I ask, unable to ignore the barb. I gesture imperiously to the rope. "Just fix it so that we can keep going." He gives me a mock bow.
"Yes, apprentice."
Tension fills the air between us as he readjusts our line to set us on a new trajectory down. My hands hurt badly, even with the gloves, but fear and pride compel me to keep my grip through the discomfort. We continue rappelling down, and though we are still cautious, both of us move a little more quickly. That last avalanche was too close a call, and we're eager to make it to the plateau I'd noticed earlier and finally get a real rest. Closer and closer it gets, and despite Li Wei's warnings, I find myself sneaking peaks down. I don't know what I was expecting in the lands near the mountain's bottom, but the terrain below us looks similar to what we left behind on the mountain's top, filled with green, dense forest. The only difference is that from this height, it is all in miniature, almost as though we're looking down at an incredibly lifelike map. When we are level with some of the trees growing on the plateau, I hear another boulder above us, in Li Wei's direction. I tug the joining rope and nod. He scurries to get out of the way, but in his haste, his grip on the rope slips. He loses his foothold, and all I can do is gasp as he starts to fall. The rope around me snaps tight, pulled taut around my torso by his added weight, cutting off my ability to get air. I jerk forward, struggling to keep my grip firmly on the rope. Gravity wants to take me down with him, and the rope begins to slip through my fingers. I fight for breath, watching the terror on Li Wei's face as he is suspended in the air, hanging only by the rope connecting him to me. Panicked, he kicks wildly, reaching out with his hands and feet to make contact with something, anything. He is too far from his original rope or the cliff face to truly touch them, and his frantic flailing only makes it more difficult for me to cling to my rope. It's slipping through my hands, bit by bit. Soon I will be at its end, and there will be nothing to stop us both from falling to our deaths. Gritting my teeth, I squeeze my fingers tightly around the rope, refusing to give another inch. More wild maneuvering from Li Wei throws me off balance, causing me to lose my foothold on the cliff. I cling to the rope for dear life now, but I can see it is a losing battle. Li Wei's weight is too great, his pull on the adjoining line too strong. Pain sears my stomach as the rope digs into me, stretched as taut as it can possibly get. My hands slip again down the rope, and I struggle to draw breath until... In seconds, it's all gone. The pressure is gone. There is no more pull, no impossible weight for me to fight against. I can breathe again, because the rope has snapped, and Li Wei is falling. There is nothing to save him, and I can only watch in horror as he falls the rest of the way down. His eyes wide with terror. I hear my second human scream in as many days. This time, it's my own.
Chapter 7. The scream dies from my lips, and for a heartbeat, I hang there, stunned at what has just happened. I take in the awful sight of Li Wei's body, lying inert on the plateau below. A million things go through my mind, all that I should have said to him, and never did. A moment later, I spur myself to action. Moving quickly, maybe too quickly, I repel the rest of the way down, knowing I'm being reckless, but too anxious to get to his side. A few rocks skitter after me, but nothing else significant. When I hit the ground, I run over to his side, afraid of what I will find. He can't be dead. He can't be dead, I keep telling myself. He can't be. The first thing I see is that he is breathing, and I nearly collapse in relief. I gently tilt his face toward mine, and his eyes flutter open. He looks a bit addled, but his pupils are normal size, and it's clear he recognizes me. My heart nearly bursts. He starts to lift his hands to speak, but I shake my head. Don't, I sign to him. We need to assess the extent of your injuries. Carefully, I help him sit up. I make him test the functionality of each limb. And amazingly, nothing appears to be broken. There is some tenderness in the foot he landed on, but he's still able to put weight on it. Rather than falling straight down, he slid a fair amount of the way on the rocky wall. It saved him from the brunt of the impact, but tore up his exposed skin and his clothes. If he'd come down at a different angle, or if we'd been just a little higher in elevation, I know the story wouldn't have had a happy ending. As it is, it's clear Li Wei is still in a lot of pain, though, as usual, he's trying to appear tough. An outcropping of rock provides a protective roof, and I decide this area will be our camp. Although the afternoon skies are clear, there's a psychological safety to being under some cover, especially if any more rocks come falling. I leave Li Wei resting there and venture out into some of the scraggly trees nearby in search of wood, so that we can make a fire when night comes. I have to break a few larger limbs in half, but for the most part, there is an ample supply of fallen branches. When I have an armful of firewood, I decide to search for a water source to refill our canteens. I haven't gone very far when I hear the snapping of a branch behind me. I spin around in alarm, relaxing when I see Li Wei. Surprised, he asks,
"How did you know I was here?"
"I heard you," I tell him, briefly setting my firewood down. "What are you doing here? You're supposed to be resting."
"I'm no delicate flower,"
he teases. I raise an eyebrow at that, and he explains more seriously.
"I was worried. You were gone a while."
"I wanted to find some water."
"Our supply will last a little longer," he says. "Wait until I can come look with you."
I nearly snap back that he's coddling me again. But after his near-death experience, I find it difficult to chastise him. It's still hard for me to shake the pall cast by those terrifying moments when I saw his body lying motionless on the rocks below. Looking him over now, I see that his concern isn't because he thinks I'm incapable, but simply because he cares about me. That realization stirs up the already conflicting emotions within me, and I avert my eyes. "Okay," I say. "Let's go back to camp." Back by the shelter of the cliff, we each eat one of the lunch packs and try not to think about how little food there is left. The terrain on this plateau seems as inhospitable to growing food as our own village, so it's unlikely we're going to find anything in the wild. We'll just have to wait until we get to the bottom of the mountain. Surely the township must have a reliable way of sustaining its food supply.
"This is good,"
Li Wei says, gesturing to the food in front of him.
"Almost worth going on this crazy climb and getting myself killed."
"You shouldn't joke about that," I say, but it's hard not to smile. "You know, that's why I climbed the shed that day, for food." He tilts his head curiously.
"What do you mean?"
His gaze holds mine, and I try not to blush as I explain. "There was this story going around about how there was a stash of food being hidden on the roof. I think it was just something the older kids made up to tease us, but I believed it. Zhang Jing was sick at the time, and I thought she'd feel better if she had more to eat. So I climbed up to see if the story was true."
"And you found out that the only true thing was that the shed really was in bad shape,"
he finishes. I nod, expecting him to laugh at me. But he only asks,
"Why didn't you ever tell me this before? I always thought you did it for the thrill of it."
"I know," I say. "And I've always known. I've always known you thought I was brave because of it, even back then. I guess I liked you thinking of me that way. I was afraid of you knowing the truth."
"That you did it to help your sister? You don't think that's brave, too?"
"It doesn't sound as exciting," I say. "Certainly not when you're six."
"You care about her a lot,"
he remarks. I lift my head so I can squarely meet his eyes. "You know I do."
"That's why you're here, and why you joined the artists, to give her a better life."
"It's more than that," I tell him. "Painting is part of me. It's more than a job. It gives me meaning, and makes me feel complete." I can see he doesn't understand, and I don't blame him. Mining is the only vocation he's ever had available to him, and there's no love in it. As he said before, it's obligation. If he doesn't mine, others starve. He stifles a yawn, and I urge him to sleep while I keep watch. He doesn't argue and stretches out on his side of the fire, soon falling asleep with ease. I watch him for a long time, studying the lines of his face and noting how strands of dark hair have come loose from their bindings. They rest gently on his cheek, and I have an overwhelming desire to brush them aside. No good can come of that. So I try to distract myself by taking in the other sights and sounds around me. The observer in me is still doing her job, still wanting to make note of every detail so that I can paint them into the record. Already I can imagine how I'd depict what's happened to us so far, which scenes I'd draw and how I'd annotate with calligraphy. My fingers itch for paint and brush, but there's nothing but rock and barren trees. Looking down at my hands, bloodied and scraped from the rope, even with gloves on, I wonder if I'd be able to do much, even if I had the right tools. When Li Wei wakes, he claims to be feeling better, but we both agree to spend the night here. He says it'll be better for us to go when the light returns, but I'm still worried about his foot and ankle. The climb is treacherous enough without injury. He assures me he'll be fine and encourages me to sleep while he takes a turn at keeping watch. I'm exhausted, but have difficulties falling asleep. I didn't think much about our situation when he was sleeping, but now I'm overwhelmed with the realization of how taboo it is for us to be out here alone together. It has nothing to do with rank either, though that simply increases the forbidden nature of it all. Elder Lien has lectured us many times on proper behavior between boys and girls, darkly warning of how dangerous feelings can arise. I'm not that worried about any feelings arising, though. They're already here, no matter how I try to suppress them. At last, I shift so that my back is to him, giving me a faint sense of privacy. Despite the uncomfortable ground, I finally fall asleep. Strange dreams fill my sleep, more puzzling than frightening. I keep hearing that noise that startled me so much that first night, when hearing returned to me, the sound I recognize now as many voices crying out. It's paired with that sense of someone trying to reach me, but I'm still unable to determine who or why. When I wake, the sun is setting. Li Wei has started a fire, and to my surprise, I see he has a knife out and is carving a piece of wood. A memory of the chrysanthemums he made for me returns, and I scoot over to watch him work. Beside him is a pile of small, round discs. I pick one up and smile when I see the character for soldier carved on it. "You're making a xiong qi set?" Sifting through the discs, I recognize other pieces from the game. General, advisor, and elephant. Li Wei shrugs and sets his work down.
"I needed something to do. Maybe you can draw us a board, apprentice."
I set the pieces down and begin smoothing out the dirt in a flat area near the fire. I use a narrow pointed branch as a stylus, and even with my injured hands, I find I can still draw a steady line. There is comfort in this kind of work, something familiar in an otherwise strange place. I draw all the lines with as much diligence as I would in painting the daily record. When I finish, I discover Li Wei watching me work. He seems embarrassed when I notice.
"You really are good at that,"
he says. It is almost grudging. "Drawing in the dirt?"
"You know what I mean. Those lines are perfect. I can't draw anything that straight."
"I couldn't do that," I say, nodding to the neat rows of game pieces he's crafted. "You've improved over the years."
"It's just a hobby,"
he says modestly. His face darkens a little.
"Something my father and I used to do to pass the time when we weren't working."
"You have a lot of skill," I say honestly. "You should do something with it." I trail off, unable to finish the thought. There is no real need for artistic woodworking in our village. All construction is simply done with brute labor. The focus is on practicality, not aesthetics. My skills with brush and pen are coveted by the elders, but the record has no need for a carver. The sculptures that have survived in our village come from a different era. I think back to what I told Li Wei earlier, about how painting gives me meaning. I wonder if he'd feel the same way if he could make woodworking his vocation.
"I'm of more use to our village hacking metals from the earth than coaxing beautiful things from wood,"
he says, guessing my thoughts. "I know," I reply, "and it's a shame." A lull falls between us, marked only by the shifting of wood in the fire. I've made and watched countless fires burn throughout my life, but never had any idea of the sounds they made. They're fascinating, and I long to know the words to describe them. Li Wei gestures at the chess pieces.
"Shall we play before all the light is gone?"
We don't have a lot of time for recreation at the Peacock Court. Just occasional holidays. Xiongqi boards are rare. Like carvings and sculpture, no one has the time or means to